All right, so this is lesson 11, trusting authority. So we've talked about authority already one time before. Basically what we've said is there's only one authority. But now what Jesus wants to do for his disciples and for us is to make sure that they understand exactly what he means by authority. So we really haven't defined authority, and he really wants to do that because the world's authority is very different than the authority in the kingdom. So the word even that Matthew uses for Jesus' authority is different than the word he uses for the world's authority. So we'll have that both in here, and he uses different words because they mean completely different ways of doing things. The word he uses for Jesus' authority actually means the ability, power, and right to do something, and in this case, for Jesus' case, in order to do God's, to fulfill God's plan. In other words, to restore wholeness. So when Jesus talks about his authority, he means that he has the power and ability and the right to restore wholeness, to restore Genesis, to restore creation, to get everything back where it was. And if he does indeed have this authority, then it means that he will know what works, when it should work, and how it will work. So the issue then for us becomes one of trust. So Matthew puts forth in these next two chapters Jesus' really whole invitation to that. Jesus says, here's what my authority looks like. And of course, it's going to be mysterious and radical and paradoxical. Here's what it's going to look like. Will you trust it? Will you believe that I have the right and the power and, of course, the desire to restore you along with all of creation in any way I see fit? And that, it's a beneficial thing to embrace. All through the Gospel of Matthew, he's already been acting like he's in charge, like he is the king who's bringing in a new kingdom. He's already acting with this authority. The last week of his life, which we're entering now, he will definitively throw down the glove and say, will you receive this authority? Or what authority will you receive for your life? And so what we have here is the rest of the couple chapters are, we've had the parables of the kingdom, we've had the parables of grace, and these will be parables of judgment. And what that means is, you are the judge because you are the one who makes the decision about whose authority you will let your life lay on, either Jesus' authority or someone else's. Elijah, I think she had you look up the story of Elijah, which was fun for me, having just been there, to remember where it was. But Elijah says, how long will you stand with two different what is exactly what he say? How long will you stand with two different positions? That's not exactly how it is. If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal, or you yourself, is God, then go ahead, follow that. That's really what Jesus is saying here. It's really what Jesus is saying by every action and every parable that he tells from here on in. I'm the authority. I'm the one who actually has the right and the ability to restore things to wholeness. But you get to choose. Do you want to choose my authority, my right and ability to do it? Or do you think you have the ability to bring back wholeness? Do you think some other God, which really falls down to you, has it? You judge. You make the decision. And so when we talk about the parables of judgment, we're really talking about you making a decision, you making a judgment about what you're going to trust your life to, which authority. So what Jesus is going to do from here on in is he's going to first define his authority, define what true authority looks like. He's going to establish his authority, and that we have as we go into Jerusalem. And then he's going to ask you to challenge authority. He's going to ask you basically to decide, make a judgment on authority. And so he has all these parables. I think one of the most important things you need to understand in these next two chapters is that the context is authority, and then in that context is trusting. So the word believe will be in there a lot. Authority is underneath every single one in here. And you need to know that. And this is one of those things I want to be able to start teaching you is, first find out what the big picture is. What's the key word? What's the key concept? So that you can interpret everything underneath that. When you don't do that, you start taking things out and interpreting. So we'll have at least one passage in here that everyone has taken out and said, oh, that's about prayer. But that's not the concept that we're talking about. So why would you do that, except that you took it out of the context? So it's always important that you understand he's talking about authority here, and he's asking you to judge it. So it's got to fit into there. And it's the way that you begin to see things. You've got to come out with that first and then to be able to say, well, how does that fit? And really wrestle with that. So we go first. He starts first with the parable of the laborers. So tell me the story of the parable of the laborers in Matthew 20, starting with 1. How does the parable go?
Who worked all day, and then there were several who came at the end who received the same wage for not the same amount of work. And so people who were there all day were unhappy.
Okay. Unhappy. Mild term. okay. So let's begin with that. Let's begin with the very first laborers that come on the scene. The very first laborers actually come in transaction mode right away. Notice that it says they agreed. In other the way that it is written in that syntax there is when the landowner agreed with the laborers. So in other words, the laborers set the price. When the landowner agreed with them for a certain amount, then he sent them into the vineyard and they worked ahead. The rest of them, the landowner goes out and finds them standing idle. And it says this a couple times. He finds them standing idle. They're doing nothing. And he goes out and finds them. And he offers them work, right? He offers them really purpose because they're doing nothing. They have nothing. And they're glad to accept the work. So what we have here right away is we have a group of people who come at life in a transactional way. Look, I have something to give. Here it is. Do you agree or not? Okay, you agree. Great. I'm going to go work for you. Where the others come at it from a different point of view. So let's look at first those laborers that agree for a specific wage. They believe they have something to bargain with. So they don't see the landowners coming to them as a gift. They see it as, oh, finally, I'm going to bargain with someone. I have something to give. And here's someone who could use it.
He needs something.
Yes, exactly. He needs something, and I have it to give, so good. And at any time I'm living a transactional way, in transactional living, I'm always going to be looking for the best deal. Mm-hmm. I'm always going to make, here's a good deal that I could build myself up in, that I could build up my own kingdom. And because of that, when they, at the end, find that the other workers who haven't worked as long or as hard get the same amount, their first complaint is, you treated them as equal as us. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're really, really upset about. Mm-hmm. You treated them as equal to us, but we bargained for the best deal. We bargained for ourselves. We had something to give, and we bargained for a really good deal, and you didn't give it to us. So what they have done is they always come at life from what they put into it. So life is always about what they've put into it. And for us, life is often about what we've put into it. That's where we start. Because we're making our own life and we're trusting our own picture of life. And in fact, this is one of the words they use, and you have to remember this as we go into how Jesus lives. They say, we have borne the burden. We've borne the burden of life. We've taken on that. So you see, life starts out from their point of view, and it's all about them carrying life. And that's where their whole perspective is. They are seeing themselves as the ones who can make life whole. They're seeing their own authority. And anytime I always look at my authority, I trust my life to my authority, it's always going to be transactional. Because it always will start with me trying to get better for myself, trying to make life for myself and get more.
Well, I mean, they decided on what was good. Mm-hmm. And they were just really mad that someone else
yep.
got a different picture of good.
That's right, exactly.
I really
right.
worked hard for this picture of
yeah.
good.
I bore the burden for this picture. I mean, I really worked hard. I mean, this happens all the time to us. You know, we feel like we've obeyed God and we've done everything, and something happens in our life, and our first question to God is, but God, I've done everything you've wanted me to do. Why should this bad thing happen to me?
Or why should that good thing happen to them?
Or right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
So,
yeah.
and the funny thing is, we would never say that, but inside we're feeling a little bit like that's not fair, mm-hmm. right? So that's exactly what the picture of these first laborers
is. Is that the keyword fair?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is that the test where they find ourselves?
Right, exactly. When we say fair, yeah, we know, oh, you are in transactional mode, and you're not looking at life as a gift. You're not looking at anything you get as a gift. You're starting from here. Oh, this is what I put in, and I need to get something out. In fact, I need to get out as much, if not more, than what I put in. So that's where those laborers are. The rest of the laborers are people who the landowner came and said, hey, would you work for me? I will make sure that you're paid. That's all he says. They have no expectations. They only have an expectancy that good will come out of it. Mm-hmm. They have just, this is what they understood, what they understand. They didn't start out with anything. They received good because they know that they didn't have life until that gift was given. They were their idol. They had no purpose, nothing to do, and they know that somebody came to them and gave them. They know that's when life started for them. They know that they had nothing to begin with or to bargain with. And here someone came and gave them purpose. You see the whole switch of how a life goes depending on where you start.
Relationship was based on trust.
It was absolutely, and why could they trust? Because they were completely empty of themselves.
Right.
They had nothing to trust in themselves. Whereas the first people felt like, you know what, I'm pretty good. I can trust myself to get myself wholeness, goodness. Whereas the others absolutely received a gift and didn't bargain with the landowner. Didn't say, well, I'm worth this much. They knew they had nothing before the gift came. What they understood is that the giving of work and purpose is an undeserved gift. And that true authority has the ability and power to restore through giving. So.
I don't want to be too tangential,
mm-hmm.
but can you put that alongside of the curse of work? Work. Do you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
The difference between
The difference between those two, and I don't really want to get too much into this, is that the work that was a curse, they chose. Because they chose to be independent. So that was all the work right. For their work that they produce, it's just like the first laborer's work.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's definitely a curse because you don't get what you put into it.
Okay.
I was thinking God called them to the work.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
The first group called
yes.
themselves. Well, what I'm saying is work
could be
a blessing
right.
Or
exactly. Depending on how you.
Do you know what
right.
I mean?
Exactly how you approach it. Are you approaching it from I have something to give and I'm giving and I'm giving and I'm giving and I'm not getting? Then it's a curse. Right. So. A transactional life is always a question of rule. If I want my kingdom, my picture to happen, and I want it to come to fruition, then I'm going to need to have you give up something for me. in order for me to get ahead. We've talked a lot about this in other studies, so I kind of want to zip through that. But my whole focus is on getting my picture accomplished. Therefore, at some point, you will get in my way, and I will have to devalue you. Because we can't all have our pictures accomplished. It just doesn't work that way. No one can have their whole picture done without devaluing someone else. Because Sherilyn's picture and Kim's picture will intersect at some point, and somebody is going to lose out. All that to say, what happens with Jesus as right after this? So he gives this parable of, and it's really a parable of judgment. Again, it's a decision that you make. So stop the idea of judgment being God saying, you're bad. Judgment is actually a decision being made, and it's you making the decision. It's you saying, either I start out with something to bargain with, or I'm empty, and you brought me a gift.
You know what's really funny about that is that I think all my life, I don't know about any of you guys, I've just interpreted, or it's been interpreted for me, that parable was more about, okay, being okay with, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Whatever God decides to do for other people, even if it's the same.
Right.
Instead of looking at it as the person who accepts the invitation versus the person who is being transactional.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is funny, because you kind of stay where you were.
Right. Exactly. So, you have to just, begin to... And I would think that everything we've studied in Matthew helps us to make that shift a little easier. But it's important information that happens so that when Jesus pulls his disciples aside, a lot of these sections that we have, it seems like they're just an aside, like, oh, he just started talking to the disciples and now we're back again talking about authority. But remember what Jesus is doing first. He's defining authority. And first and foremost, authority, true authority, will give grace to all. So true authority gives. And it gives grace, and it intends to give grace to all. Not all will receive it, but it intends to give grace to all. So now what Jesus does, he tells that parable, and then he pulls his disciples aside. And it's a very interesting thing that he does. What does he tell the disciples when he pulls them aside? Verse 17 through 19.
Can we read it?
Sure.
Now Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. On the way, he took the 12 aside and said to them, "We are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life."
Okay, why does Jesus do this? Why does he pull his disciples aside to tell them this?
So they don't get in the way?
Yeah, exactly. Hey guys, this is the purpose. This is why we're going there. I intend to take this on. I intend, actually, and I think this is the best word I can use, I intend to absorb the worst that transactional living can do. This is my intention. Don't get in the way. Because, of course, that would be our natural bent, right? No. I mean, Peter's already said this.
Right.
No, Lord. And so he's going, hey, guys, by the way, do you remember? This is why we're going. I'm going to absorb the worst that transactional living can do. I'm going to absorb it so that I can restore life.
Well, and don't let your picture of life get in the way
right.
of me actually bringing life to all mankind.
Exactly. This is the whole intention that he has. And so he lays it out before he does it. Now, of course, I think it's in Luke, it says that they had no idea what he's talking about. They still don't understand. And of course, Jesus probably knows. They're not getting it yet, but little by little, they will. So let's just really pull that apart really quickly. The worst that transactional life can do to anybody, it's really, I love that he delineates the things that he's going to go through, because it's really the end results of transactional living. We do this to everybody. Just like when we say murder, we murder people with our words and things like that.
Yeah.
That's really what's happening here, is this slow progression of devaluing someone, of what we do. And we don't always get down to that crucifixion part, but we almost always get close when we really live transactionally in order to uphold my worthiness, my kingdom, that I have something to give. So he starts with that they will he will be delivered or betrayed. So when we live transactionally, we give the person over to something else, not our relationship with them. We give it over. We put it away from us in order to protect or increase our own kingdom, our own picture. And I'm going to go through these quickly because I hope that you kind of get this already. Condemnation is judging, and it's judging them as unworthy or not beneficial to you. So when I'm living with other people transactionally, I'm really pushing them away from a full relationship, and I'm saying, you're really not beneficial to me except in a transactional way. So you're not beneficial in a relationship way, but in a transactional way. In other words, you're just a thing, which is exactly what they begin to do with Jesus. And we see the whole progression of Jesus last week. We see that that's what they're doing. It's all about them. It's really not about him as much. It goes down to mocking. And basically, you're going to mock someone when you want to make sure that they know that they're just a joke to you, that you have completely taken away any value that they might have for you. Scourging is actually taking away flesh. It actually is ripping off flesh. So that what you do is you make another person disgusting in the eyes of everybody else. And we've done that, right? Mm-hmm. We've done that by our words and by our actions. We want to make sure everyone else sees how unworthy they are. That's why they would scourge someone. So it's not just to inflict pain. In fact, it's much more so that everyone else sees how unworthy they are. And then we get down, of course, to the crucifixion, where they take someone's life by violence, by pain, which is what we often do when we live transactionally. It will get down to that. So this is really that slow progression of where transactional life goes with relationships with people. What Jesus says in here is he's proposing that he is going to go to those things and he's going to absorb them instead of fight them. And that's really important that we understand that as we go in here. Because if he fights them, if he fights all of that transactional way with him, he just continues the cycle. Because if he fights it, then they keep all those transactional stuff and they're going to fight more and they're going to build up more transactions and then he has to build up more transactions. Do you see that? So if I fight somebody that's trying to be transactional with me, I just increase the battle. He says, yeah, I'm going to do battle a completely different way. I'm going to absorb it. I'm going to take it in. And when I take it in from them, they're left without it. So they're left with the ability actually to have a different life. So what I want to do, just a little visual. I want you to take in a little visual. So we begin to understand what Jesus is doing when he encounters transactional living, when he encounters people trying to build up their own kingdom, trying to live under their own authority. So I want you each to take a white cloth, and I want you to, now my house looks fairly clean. It usually looks fairly clean, but it's not. There is filth and dirt everywhere, but where would that be? In a house that normally looks pretty uncluttered, where is the dirt going to be?
Couch.
Yeah, so it's going to be hidden, right? It's going to be in corners. It's going to be little places. I haven't dusted or anything for at least since we've been, so at least for a week and probably longer. Dusting, yeah, I don't dust too much. What I want you to do is I want you to go around the house and I want you to take your very white rag and I want you to absorb places that are hiding dirt, that are hiding grime. Now, you can. I don't care where you go in the house. You can go anywhere in the house. The funny thing is, though, when I started thinking about this, I wanted to clean. No, Jill, that's fine. So I want you to go anywhere in the house, and I want you to look at your white rag, and then I want you to make sure you get to places that are hiding dirt and grime. And after you're done, I want you to look at the place you've absorbed the dirt from, and then bring your rag back. So go ahead.
And next week we'll all come to my house.
Let's go play the game at my house.
A few extra in case anyone.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. I'm going to go back here behind the couch.
Yay!
Pardon me if I invade your personal space.
Look, I'm spider. Oh, yeah, it's coming up.
Oh, that would be a good thing to get on there.
I saw Dr. Collins last week, finally.
Yes.
I had to wait forever to get in. Oh, good. Well, she put me on for testing every day, and blood work, which I haven't gotten back yet, and hopefully I'm on a very clean diet for a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
not right away. Yeah. So I'm buying these groceries, and I run out of stuff, so it's kind of not like right away, because I have food to eat up.
Right,
I'm not
right.
Just dump. So, yeah, my family's like, I don't want to eat that. So, but I think everybody will feel better.
Oh, good.
Once I clean it, you want me to clean the rest of it?
Sure.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Jill, this is a great way to get your house clean. Great.
Yeah, and as I'm looking, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I never did. Oh, wait, does that.
Perfect. I know, but then you got to clean.
I know.
That should make you happy. That's a picture in itself, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You didn't have to do it by yourself.
Right.
It wasn't very much, though. You
find yeah, go find more.
Just everybody else. There, go find more.
Chunks of banana. That's not for a
it wouldn't
banana.
Slow me down.
One and I like the looks of that, and they get kind of
icky. I kind of think Bed Bath & Beyond,
yeah.
I think, but I'm not
you
positive.
Don't remember.
Or Target.
This, it was hard to find, but I found
ah,
a little.
There you go.
A little.
Girls!
That was nice to get some nooks and crannies.
There you go. All right, so you look at your rag, and your rag hopefully is no longer white, right?
Slightly.
Yeah. What did you clean, Linda?
I started making things dirty again.
Oh, yeah, that was going to be the worst. I thought about that.
I did on top of your doorbell.
Okay.
Can I do a commercial for Swiffers?
Yes. So when you looked at the spot that you absorbed the dirt from, what did the spot look like? Cleaner, yeah. Better, right? New, without anything on top of it, right? So I want you to begin to understand that that's what Jesus is doing. Actually, he's been doing that, and he's going to continue to do that. And we'll, of course, talk through that more and more. But I want to—I know I've read this to you before. It is still my favorite poem, I guess you could call it, story by Walter Rangren. But it just fits. And I thought, oh, I can't go without this. Who likes Walter?
I love him. When I was Lutheran, you get the Lutheran magazine every month, and he always had a...
Oh, yeah. Yes.
What's the book,
Jill? Ragman. He is an amazing man, and I have gotten to meet him. My sister and I used to go to church with him. So let me read this. So just sit back. I saw a strange sight. I stumbled upon a story most strange, like nothing my life, my street sense, my sly tongue had ever prepared me for. Hush, child, hush now, and I will tell it to you. Even before the dawn one Friday morning, I noticed a young man, handsome and strong, walking the alleys of our city. He was pulling an old cart filled with clothes, both bright and new, and he was calling in a clear tenor voice, "Rags!" Ah, the air was foul, and the first light filthy to be crossed by such sweet music. "Rags! New rags for old! I take your tired rags! Rags!" Now this is a wonder, I thought to myself. For the man stood 6'4", and his arms were like tree limbs, hard and muscular, and his eyes flashed intelligence. Could he find no better job than this, to be a ragman in the inner city? I followed him. My curiosity drove me, and I wasn't disappointed. Soon the ragman saw a woman sitting on her back porch. She was sobbing into a handkerchief, sighing and shedding a thousand tears. Her knees and elbows made a sad X. Her shoulders shook. Her heart was breaking. The ragman stopped his cart. Quietly, he walked to the woman, stepped round tin cans, dead toys, and Pampers. "Give me your rag," he said so gently, "and I'll give you another." He slipped the handkerchief from her eyes. She looked up, and he laid across her palm a linen cloth so clean and new that it shined. She blinked from the gift to the giver. Then as he began to pull his cart again, the ragman did a strange thing. He put her stained handkerchief to his own face, and then he began to weep, to sob as grievously as she had done, his shoulders shaking. Yet she was left without a tear. "This is a wonder," I breathed to myself, and I followed the sobbing ragman like a child who cannot turn away from mystery. "Rags, rags, new rags for old!" In a little while, when the sun showed gray behind the rooftops and I could see the shredded curtains hanging out black windows, the ragman came upon a girl whose head was wrapped in a bandage, whose eyes were empty. Blood soaked her bandage. A single line of blood ran down her cheek. Now the tall ragman looked upon this child with pity, and he drew a lovely yellow bonnet from his cart. "Give me your rag," he said, tracing her own line on her cheek, "and I'll give you mine." The child could only gaze at him while he loosened the bandage, removed it, and tied it to his own head. The bonnet he set on hers, and I gasped at what I saw, for with the bandage went the wound. Against his brow it ran a darker, more substantial blood, his own. "Rags, rags, I take old rags," cried the sobbing, bleeding, strong, intelligent ragman. The sun hurt both the sky now and my eyes. The ragman seemed more and more to hurry. "Are you going to work?" he asked a man who leaned against a telephone pole. The man shook his head. The ragman pressed him. "Do you have a job?" "Are you crazy?" sneered the other. He pulled away from the pole, revealing the right sleeve of his jacket, flat, the cuff stuffed into the pocket. He had no arm. "So," said the ragman, "give me your jacket, and I'll give you mine." Such quiet authority in his voice. The one-armed man took off his jacket. So did the ragman, and I trembled at what I saw, for the ragman's arm stayed in its sleeve. And when the other put it on, he had two good arms, thick as tree limbs, but the ragman had only one. "Go to work," he said. After that, he found a drunk lying unconscious beneath an army blanket, an old man hunched, wizened, and sick. He took that blanket and wrapped it around himself, but for the drunk, he left new clothes. And now I had to run to keep up with the ragman. Though he was weeping uncontrollably and bleeding freely at the forehead, pulling his cart with one arm, stumbling for drunkenness, falling again and again, exhausted, old and sick, yet he went with terrible speed. On spider's legs, he skittered through the alleys of the city, this mile and the next, until he came to its limits, and then he rushed beyond. I wept to see the change in this man. I hurt to see his sorrow, and yet I needed to see where he was going in such haste, perhaps to know what drove him so. The little old ragman, he came to a landfill. He came to the garbage pits. And then I wanted to help him in what he did, but I hung back, hiding. He climbed a hill. With tormented labor, he cleared a little space on that hill. Then he sighed. He lay down. He pillowed his head on a handkerchief and a jacket. He covered his bones with an army blanket, and he died. Oh, how I cried to witness that death. I slumped in a junked car and wailed and mourned as one who has no hope, because I had come to love the ragman. Every other face had faded in the wonder of this man, and I cherished him, but he died. I sobbed myself to sleep. I did not know, how could I know, that I slept through Friday and Saturday and its night too. But then on Sunday morning, I awakened by a violence. Light, pure, hard, demanding light, slammed against my sour face, and I blinked, and I looked, and I saw the last and the first wonder of all. There was the ragman, folding the blanket most carefully, a scar on his forehead, but alive, and besides that, healthy. There was no sign of sorrow nor of age, and all the rags that he had gathered shined for cleanliness. Well, then I lowered my head, and trembling for all that I had seen, I myself walked up to the ragman. I told him my name with shame, for I was a sorry figure next to him. Then I took off all my clothes in that place, and I said to him with dear yearning in my voice, "Dress me." He dressed me. My Lord, he put new rags on me, and I am a wonder beside him. The ragman, the Christ. That's what Jesus is telling his disciples he's intending to do. He is going to absorb all of the transactions that man can throw. What is it with your cloth attached to you that you can do with this cloth? Do you have to keep that dirt that you absorbed? What can you do with it? You can wash it. You can actually bring it to the water, right? The place that you cleaned couldn't do it, right? It couldn't get itself up and walk over to the water and wash it. But you can attach to that rag, get up and do that. And we'll look at those pictures a little bit more, but certainly a picture of Trinity, of being able to go to the water that cleanses. So, what is Jesus doing? He is trying to define authority. What authority looks like. The ragman, that's authority. That's what real authority looks like. So real authority gives, real authority absorbs and restores life. Real authority humbles himself, humbles himself. The next thing we have is that funny story about James and John's mother coming to Jesus and asking for a special seat for her boys. I always think this is such a funny story, but remember, it's within the context of authority. So Matthew is putting forth what Jesus means by authority and what it looks like. And here he's saying what authority looks like is that it humbles itself. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, see, James and John's mother knew that James and John were really Jesus' closest friends beside Peter. Peter and James and John were Jesus' closest friends. So she asks this, like, well, this just seems like a good thing, a normal thing.
Well, and she probably was like starting to get that things were coming to a close, right?
Right, absolutely. Yep, right.
It's not
yep.
really good in Jerusalem.
Yep, it's come, but you know, kingdom's coming, so let's get this. And of course, she is still in transactional mindset, which plays exactly against what he's just talked about. And really what he uses this opportunity, why Matthew inserts it here, is Jesus uses the opportunity to say, look, I'm warning you, don't take your discipleship as a transactional one. Don't live as if discipleship is transactional. You've chosen to follow me, but don't make it a transactional discipleship. He's already told them they're going to receive 10 times more than they've ever given up. He's already told them, don't worry, I'm going to give you good. But if they want it to be a transaction, if they think following mama's lead, because what we see here is not only does the mother ask, but James and John are right there. They're like, yeah, yeah, go ahead, mom. Because he asks a question right then. Do you think you can take the cup? And they say, yeah, yeah, we can do that. So they're right there. And he's saying, yeah, you are actually going to. You're actually going to feel some of that same thing. But don't take it as a transaction. If you want to do that, you're not going to get what you expect. You're not going to have your picture fulfilled. And if you take it as a transaction rather than a gift to be a disciple, then you're not trusting that my authority can actually restore you to wholeness. You're not trusting that what I'm bringing you to and bringing you through is actually going to make you whole. You're trusting your authority, your picture, if that's how you're going to approach discipleship. I do think, and I think we kind of look over this very quickly. I really do think this is speaking to us so much because we feel like, yes, we're following Jesus, but we're still doing it in a transactional way. We want to be his disciple, but we're doing it in a transactional way. And it's really talking to the disciples right here. That's not really what you want because it means really that you're not believing, that you're not trusting that my authority can and is restoring you with whatever I'm bringing you through. And remember, he just told them, I'm going to bring you through the same stuff. I'm going to bring you through mocking and scourging and death of all sorts. Can you trust me that this is going to be a restorative thing? Can you trust me with that?
You know what I'm imagining too, though, is like, we've had all this stuff happening to Peter lately too.
Right, yes.
Okay, so there's his three closest.
Yep.
And then he's telling Peter he's going to build his rock in his church, you know, mm-hmm. blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah, all these things. Peter comes out in the water. All these things are going on with Peter. I'm sure James and John were saying to their mom, I don't know. I think he's setting Peter up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And the mother's like, well, then go get him.
Right.
You go
sure,
in there.
Sure.
If we go in there, we're going to get it.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Gonna get it.
Yeah.
Why should it all be Peter?
Right.
You've been hanging out with him just as much as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could just.
Oh,
it.
Sure, of course.
You know what I mean?
And again, they're coming from that place of, you know, we've given up everything.
Right.
You know,
right.
Peter said it, but we've given up everything too. Let's.
Right.
What are we going to get here? The interesting thing is, though, I love how Jesus treats the disciples here because he knows that they really want to follow. They just are having a hard time changing their paradigms, like us. It's really hard to do that. But what he does is he uses his own relationships, his own self. He knows he's going to death, but he's not going to use his obedience as a transaction. He knows he's going to give his whole life, but he doesn't think that gives him the right to ask his father to have his best friend sitting next to him, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Think about that. This is what I'm doing for the world. And yet he knows that does not entitle him to a right to get some part of his picture taken care of. So he's showing them in a very gentle way, look, I'm giving my life for the whole world. I'm absorbing the whole world's transactions, and I'm not feeling like that gives me the right to ask this question.
Obedience doesn't equal favor.
Absolutely. It does not equal getting your picture done. He also says he doesn't see his relationship with the Father as a bargaining chip. His dependency on the Father gets fulfilled in the relationship, not in the power that the relationship offers, not in the benefit. So a lot of times we live, and we don't, I don't think that we consciously think this, but a lot of times we look at relationships with what benefit we can get out of the relationship. Like, well, that brings me, that networks me with somebody else, or that brings me closer, rather than the relationship being the fulfillment. And Jesus is saying, actually, the relationship with my Father, my dependency on Him, is completely fulfills me, completely makes me whole. It's not the power that comes out of that relationship that I want to grasp. It's just the relationship. And that is how He's asking the disciples to come along, to trust them that actually is where they're going to get their wholeness from. So, what does true authority do? It gives grace to all. It absorbs transactions in order to restore life. And it humbles itself. It allows the Father to make the decision. So even though Jesus as a man is doing all of the things, He allows the Father to make the decision, which is huge for us, because when it gets right down to it, we want to be able to ones to make the decision about our own life. It's why even little kids say, "You're not the boss of me." Right? 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 Except I hear adults say the same thing, right? Sometimes they actually use those same words. And sometimes they use words that are couched, they sound prettier, but they're exactly the same, right? I want to be the boss of me. And Jesus is saying, in the kingdom, that's not how life is going to work. You're not going to get life from that. The last thing he defines authority as is, authority serves. It serves with compassion. So he goes and talks to the rest of the disciples. Now, of course, are angry. So we have, first we have Peter, and now we have James and John kind of coming, and now we have the rest of the disciples. Wait a second here. Why are James and John trying to get more power? And so Jesus tries to explain to them, look, the power of the world, the authority of the world is not what you want. It only brings death. Your authority that I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you my authority, that's going to look differently. So in defining these words, Matthew uses completely different words. We have the same English words. He says, first of all, that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over people. The word lord it means to control. So their authority is to control. And then when it uses that great men exercise authority, that word authority actually means to have privilege over you with opposition. So I have privilege over you. I'm over you. And there is some opposition there because I'm over you. Basically, worldly power, transactional power says, I, the authority, am worthy. So the authority is where the worth is. Jesus says, godly power, kingdom authority, actually serves in order to heal. It doesn't seek control, it seeks service in order to heal. This authority, instead of saying, I, the authority, am worthy, this authority, kingdom authority, says, you are worthy. You are worthwhile. It tells the other person that they are worthwhile. So kingdom authority is always focused on the other person, that the other person has worth. And then Jesus demonstrates it. So we have what looks like these just little snippets, but it's all one string. He teaches them this is what authority is, and then he shows them. And he shows them by the fact that he is on his way to Jerusalem. And I've heard many, many sermons about Jesus didn't turn one way or the other when he was on his way to Jerusalem. His face was there, and it was one way only. And yet, on the way to Jerusalem, what does he do? Two blind men call out, and he stops. He stops his journey in order to show compassion, to serve two blind men. So he shows what that authority is always looking out for the other person to show their worth, that they are worthy of coming into the kingdom. So he stops his journey. He heals the blind men so that they have their eyes open. Boy, we could go into that parable. It's a great parable. I think we'll leave that and let you look at that. But he opens their eyes in order so that they might be able to see what's coming up. That the events coming up in Jesus' life are more than what we think. That it's not an end or defeat, but the beginning. It is Jesus absorbing rather than fighting the transaction. So we come to the last week of his life. We come to him entering into Jerusalem. And I do have to say, it is for me fun to picture all of that and the climb up to Jerusalem. So we're going from Jericho, which is also this place of Jericho. It figures in many places, but it's the place where, like, Elijah and Elisha changed things. It's always the turning point in Israel. It's where they crossed over from outside of Israel into Israel. It's always the turning point of something significant in Israel's life. So here we have the turning point for Jesus, and really the rest of the world, is right there at Jericho. So he begins to now travel up to Jerusalem. But before we get there, I need to give you a little bit of background of what Jewish thought is so that you understand what the Jews then would have seen right away, and we don't, because we don't think like this. We have in the past, but we've lost a lot of this. So I want you to understand that. So I'm going to give you a little background. Jewish thought held that there was something about place, something about time, and something about matter that could be so infused with God's presence that it actually became different than the rest of the places around, than the rest of time around, than the rest of matter around. It could become so wholly different than the ordinary that it became sacred, holy, special. And in fact, what they understood is that there were places and there was time and there was matter that could so be and so infused with his presence that it was actually that the area of heaven was intersecting with the area of earth. Mm-hmm. So that there was an intersection of God's domain and man's domain. And what you need to also understand is they never thought about heaven as a place that was up, first of all, and that it was up in our realm somewhere. So we tend to think of heaven as a place out there and usually up, right? They didn't think of that way at all. They actually were very progressive in their thought. Well, we've actually regressed in so many ways. They thought of heaven as a different dimension. So not as a place in our realm and just higher or and away from us, but a different dimension as earth. So earth was one dimension and heaven was another dimension. And that they, at some point, God infused his presence so much in our dimension that heaven's dimension and our dimension intersected. Does that make sense to you? I think a lot of our old sci-fi movies actually kind of bring some of this out, where there's different dimensions. I mean, I'm thinking about Twilight Zone.
Think about Land of the Lost, which, like where they go past the time portals.
Yeah, a lot of that. So that time travel kind of thing is kind of the idea that the Jews always had, that there were different dimensions, and heaven isn't just in a different dimension. But they also felt, and we studied this in Deuteronomy, that God would say, hey, I'm going to actually infuse my presence into a certain place, and I'm going to pick Israel, and I'm going to pick a specific place, Jerusalem, and then I'm going to pick an even more specific place, the temple in Jerusalem, to have my presence there. And that place was so special, that sense of place, that holiness of, this is where heaven met earth, in that place. So they had a sense of place that we don't have anymore. Now, we used to. For those of us who are older, we still had lingering ideas of certain places that were special, and church would have been one of them for us. Is definitely not anymore. But there was a sense where...
It's almost like a portal.
It was almost like a, in fact, it was meant to be. So you walk into church and all of a sudden you are, you know you've entered somewhere different. It's quiet. Like, when was the last time you walked into church and it was quiet?
During the middle of the
week. Nobody's there.
Carmel's yes. Eucharistic
yes.
chapel.
Yes, exactly. So that happens. It's why churches use incense. Because it, you, where else do you, you walk in? And that's one of the things the Anglican Church does. We have incense. And I have never liked that. But when I begin to understand, it's supposed to bring you to the place of, this place is special. This is how the Jews felt. This is how the Jews understood Jerusalem and how they understood the temple. They found that when God met, when God's domain met Earth's domain by God's choice and God's effect, that this place would be where heaven and earth met. And in reality, this is what Jesus has always been doing, to say, I'm bringing that to fruition everywhere, that heaven and earth are going to come back together, like the Garden of Eden. That's the picture of the Garden of Eden, was heaven and earth were together. They were in the same realm and dimension.
Which is kind of why they still fight about it, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Because it's more than just like a place they walk to church.
Yes, exactly.
It feels like a portal to God. It feels
yes.
like if we don't have that access point,
yes.
we're screwed.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And that is why we so don't understand that, that does, you know, we want to say, well, just take another place. No, no. See, this is the place. This is that portal where God actually is infused. Not that he isn't everywhere, but this place is full of his glory. It's why some of the pictures that they have in Revelation and in Ezekiel are this picture of God's robe, you know, just all over the place.
And I wonder if, you know, more than just the Jews recognize that.
I believe, yes. So. I do believe that that is infused in other places. Western is probably the farthest away. Western culture is the farthest away from
place. I mean, in that
place.
Conflict, like the Muslims
well,
recognize
oh.
too.
Like,
I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Muslims were not interested in making churches
right.
in a different place.
Right.
I mean, they went and were interested in making the church
there.
Old, you know,
yes.
Or the
their mosque. Yeah.
Mosque over
right. right.
churches.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
It is interesting.
Mm-hmm. So they have an idea of place that is very different. Where heaven meets earth. But they also had that idea for time and for matter. For time, do you know what would be the place where heaven and earth, heaven's time and earth's time met? Anybody get, have any idea where that would be?
For matter, you said?
For time. Sabbath.
Yeah, when it was
created.
Sabbath.
Oh, okay. So Sabbath is the place where God's time and man's time intersect. And God is, now you begin to understand Sabbath. Oh, wow, wait. This is a very holy place. And again, when I was growing up, when I was little, Sabbath, and for Christian Sundays, that was really different.
But isn't that also like what the wise men were trying to say, like, okay, something's about to intersect
yes,
here. The
yes, yes, exactly.
That there's going to be
yep.
like an opening here.
Yes, right, exactly.
Be an
yep.
intersection.
Yep, yep. So they had place, and they had time, and they had matter. And for them, matter, where heaven's matter and earth's matter intersected, were the places where God actually did something with nature that was beyond what they could have imagined. And so for them, the biggest place would have been the plagues that they saw in Exodus, right? They held on to those.
Waters
some of,
out of rock, though.
Yeah, so all the things that happened on the way, those were where matter of heaven and matter of earth intersected. Things happen that on earth shouldn't naturally happen. In other words, miracles, right? So miracles in nature would have been those places. Jesus has been demonstrating all along, from the very beginning, from his baptism on, his authority. He's been acting about his authority, his ability, and his power to reveal those intersections. The feeding of the 5,000, the walking on the water, the calming the storm, all of the healings were places where heaven and earth are intersected. This is what normally happens in the kingdom. You don't have enough food? Well, of course you have enough food. It's the kingdom. And it doesn't matter what you have in your hand, there's enough food. That's a normal thing in the kingdom. Touching a leper and him being healed, that's normal in the kingdom. So all of these things Jesus has been doing has been saying, look, heaven's invading earth. Kingdom is being set up. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. When he celebrates the Sabbath by actually just celebrating rather than fitting in the rules. Remember when he and his disciples eat? The biggest Sabbath, the biggest place, is the Jubilee Sabbath, where everything is forgiven and everyone gets to celebrate with everything. He's showing all of these intersections of where heaven and earth are meeting. He's been doing this all along. And there would have been some people who would have begun to get like, how is he able to do that? I thought the only place that could happen is in the temple. And so their minds begin and begin. So now we needed to know that as he enters Jerusalem. Because if the temple is the place where heaven and earth meets, they've always known that Jerusalem, and God designed this, that Jerusalem is the door to where heaven and earth meet. So now Jesus is entering Jerusalem. This is what they've known about place and time and matter. And Jesus has been doing this. And now all the things he does from here on in just explode that. And they make them, all of a sudden they make things become more sense to some. And to others they make enough sense that they just want to push it away. They don't want that to be true. So we have him entering Jerusalem. Now we can go back to the outline. He's going to overturn the picture of what a king looks like because he's going to come in gently, it says. That word there means to accept God's dealings with him as good without resisting or disputing. It's an attitude. Humbleness is an attitude first and foremost toward God. That all you do for me, God, all that you bring me is good. There is no separation here. He comes in gentleness, very unlike a king. Of course, the picture of a king normally. Now remember, historically, it is time. Lots of things have come together that the Jews also understand that the Messiah should be showing up anytime now. We don't usually get that idea, but they're looking. So they're expecting someone to come in war, right? That means they'd be on a horse, and they're expecting someone to come fighting. And here we have Jesus, who's been showing them these intersections of heaven come to earth, because what they know is when Israel gets completely redeemed, not only from away from the Romans and them being the blessing, but that God will return to the temple. Okay, so that's what they're looking for. They know it's coming sometime soon. And so Jesus enters humbly, and he enters on a donkey. Not just on a donkey. And I love that Matthew does this. Matthew's the only one that does this. But he says, what does he tell the disciples to go get? A donkey and a colt. Both. Two, right? The donkey is a female donkey. It's the mother. The colt is the baby. So dependent on the mother still that they have to bring the mother and the baby together. This is what Jesus wants. This is the picture of who he is. So dependent. And I love this because so many times we have pictures of God the Father as a mother, as this one who nurtures. And this is the donkey is that picture of God the Father as a mother. And the son, the baby colt, is so dependent on the mother that it must remain with her at all times. Isn't that a beautiful picture? Mm-hmm. That he makes them bring both of them, the donkey and the colt, because they need to understand that he only does this in full connection with the motherly father, the donkey here. So we have...
He first comes to earth on a donkey.
Yep, exactly. Mary. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep. So we have this beautiful, beautiful picture of things are starting to tie in now, all together. But of course, this is very paradoxical if you're coming as a king. Then, of course, the fact that he's actually on a donkey rather than a horse. A horse brings in a warrior. A donkey, what does a donkey do?
It's a beast of burden.
It's a beast of burden. For whose burdens? Yeah. The donkey's burdens? The people's burdens. Okay, go back to the vineyard, the very first parable. What did they say? We have borne the burden. Mm-hmm. We're carrying our own burdens. What does Jesus do? He puts himself as one who carries others' burdens, mm-hmm. as a donkey and a colt. Mm-hmm. And of course, a donkey and a colt is a slow-moving animal, therefore an animal of peace rather than an animal of war, which a horse would have been there. Turn to Zechariah 9 through 11. Zechariah, second to last book.
Say the reference again.
Zechariah 9 through 11. So this is, he quotes a little piece of this. I want us to see a little bigger piece. Who would like to read that, 9 through 11?
Go.
Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off, and he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea, and from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you also, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit.
Okay, that, and we could read more, but I just wanted you to see that it's not just that he is quoting there, that Matthew's quoting that this is your king coming. He's coming on a colt. Not only do we understand that he's coming on a colt, that that's peace, but he says, I'm going to cut off the chariot, the horse, and the bow of war. I'm not coming as a warrior. I'm not coming with the idea of crushing people. I'm coming with the idea of I'm going to take all their stuff on me and let myself be crushed. So it's this completely different idea. For the Jews, they understood that the Messiah was coming. They understood that there would be a suffering servant, and they understood that God would one time reign. They never, ever thought that all three would be the same person. They thought the Messiah would be one person, that the suffering servant that came before Messiah would be, and that the Messiah would allow the God to come back to the temple. And what Jesus is beginning to do here, and what they're beginning to see, is that it looks like maybe Jesus is going to be all three. So we have then what they would know when they saw Jesus doing this. They would know, first and foremost, it was a royal action, that it was a king coming to change regimes. Not only would the Jews know that, but so would the Romans. They would know that the battle was all of a sudden being redefined, not as a battle, but as a thing of peace. And they probably would have been, wow, that's not how we thought it would come. Okay. They would understand that the purpose was to establish a new rule. They would have understood that immediately. When they saw Jesus doing this, that would have come to mind. Zechariah would have come to mind. They would have understood, it looks like this guy, this prophet, is trying to bring in a new rule. And he's doing it kind of an odd way. We're not quite sure how that's going to happen. But they also knew, because he was bringing in a new rule, that freedom might be coming. So they're still set in their physical world, in their tangible, and they're thinking, he's going to set us free from the Romans. And this crowd here would have said, not only is he going to set us free from the Romans, he's going to set us free from the religious people that are ruling over us. Mm-hmm. So there would have been many people who would have understood that as well. And that they would have said, if this is Messiah and he's coming to redeem us, God then is coming to the temple again. So they were like, yes, He's going to redeem us. We're not going to be under Romans anymore. We're not going to be under these corrupt chief priests anymore. And God's going to come back to the temple. So this is what they're thinking as he's coming down the road outside the outskirts of Jerusalem. And just as a side love, whenever they called daughters of Zion, daughters actually meant the outskirts. And that's why skirts. Jerusalem was a female. Skirts were the suburbs, basically. So the Mount of Olives is in the suburb. So that's what he's talking about. He's coming to the daughters of Jerusalem, the daughters of Zion, the outskirts. And he comes down, yeah. He comes down there, and this is what they're going. They're remembering Zechariah, and they're understanding, whoa, freedom. So they're so excited that they're going to get a new rule, but they're also excited that God's coming back to the temple. And we need to understand that, so we understand that there isn't like just this Christian idea of, you know, God comes and Jesus comes and throws the money changers out of the temple. Oh, that just shattered everything they thought when he comes there. So the crowds then hail Hosanna. And we do tend to think Hosanna as, you know, yay God! The word actually means save. Oh, save us! Oh, save us! And it is actually a proclamation that says, you have the power to save us. Mm-hmm. So they're ascribing to him the power to be able to save them, to make them whole again. When they call him Son of David, they're ascribing to him the right to do so. So in that yell, Hosanna, Son of David, they're saying, you have the authority to be able to make us whole, save us. You have the right given to you by God because you are the Son of David to be able to make us whole. And then for them to throw their coats over the donkeys and on the roads and the branches is a sign of trust. Remember, we talked about this in the very beginning of Matthew. Coats were the most valuable piece of clothing they had because most often, most of the people would use their coats as their blankets as well, as protection from storms, all sorts of things. Their coats were very precious to them. In fact, the law said you couldn't take a coat any longer than a day. You had to give it back to him at night. So sometimes they used coats as pledges. I'll give you my coat to promise you this, but they understood that you had to give it back because coats were so important. So for them to lay their coats down said, we trust you with our coat. We trust that you won't take advantage of us. We trust you that what you're bringing is good, so we can give you our coat. And for them to do the branches, they actually cut branches off the trees. These weren't just branches that your priest and pastor was handing out one day. They're actually their branches from their trees. They're cutting them down. Where do they live? They live in a desert. You think leaves are important? You think branches are important? They are tremendously important in a desert. For them to cut the branches off said, we know that you're bringing enough life that it can be renewed, that new life can come. So the branches and the coats are a sign of saying, we trust your authority. We believe you have the right and the power and the ability to bring us back to where we are or where we should be.
So you don't think the coats had anything to do with this idea of, like, you know when someone's important and you throw it down over the mud so that they don't have to...
Yep, it does. So this was a common thing for anyone who they thought was a king, bringing them peace and goodness and a new rule. So yes, it was a symbol of honor, but the fact that you would give a coat rather than something else was also a sign of trust. Okay?
Yeah.
So yes, those were common ways that you would have honored someone who you believed was bringing in a new good reign as opposed to whatever you were under at the time. So what we have Jesus doing on that Palm Sunday, on that coming down, and remember, he's coming from high. Mount of Olives is really high. It overlooks Jerusalem, coming all the way down into the Kidron Valley and then over into the temple. He was overturning the idea of what a king would look like for them. He had already told the disciples and people who were following them, look, authority is going to look completely different than you think. And now he's overturning the idea of what a king is going to look like in the kingdom. So, of course, he enters Jerusalem and then goes straight to the temple. And from where he's coming, he's actually, so the temple mount sits on the east side of Jerusalem, right on the wall there. And he comes, so the very first thing he does as he comes into Jerusalem would be to encounter the temple. And he goes up into the temple through the east gate. So now he's going to overturn the picture of God. And he walks into the temple, and what he's going to do is he's going to judge the old system of the temple, what the temple has become. He first overthrows all the money changers and collectors, and he says, "You've made my father's house into what? A den of robbers." Interesting two words here. The word robber means one who openly deprives another of his property. So he's saying to them, you are openly depriving God of his kingdom. Mm-hmm. And a den is a place for hiding. Mm-hmm. You are using the temple to hide behind this transactional system, to hide behind the fact that you're keeping the kingdom away from God and the people who it belongs to. Mm-hmm. So he throws the means to do that and the controllers who are doing that out. It will no longer be legitimate for you to use the temple as a place to hide God's kingdom behind a transactional system. A system that exploited the poor, because the poor, when it says the doves, that's what the poor would have bought. Instead of bringing their own doves, they made them buy them there. See, doves were something you could have brought in. The rest of the animals would have been hard. But the doves you could have brought in on your own. But they made them buy them there. And here's the deal about that. So the temple itself made its own coinage. It only was used in the temple, which means everyone had to go through a money changer. And do you think the money changers were like, oh, you have five, you want to give 5 cents to get 5 cents? No.
It's like buying stamps from the post office.
Right, exactly. That's exactly it.
Changing money at the airport.
Right, right. Yeah. They're going to charge you a nice hefty fee. That's what a money changer was. That's what they were doing here. So not only did you have to buy your sacrifices there, but first you had to buy their money to pay for the sacrifices.
I heard they wanted.
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting. So what he's doing is he's doing away with the system that is hiding the kingdom from God and from the others. He's doing away with that because it exploits the poor, it exploits everyone who has to change their money. It also, though, deems who's worthy, because where they were at was the court of the Gentiles. Which that meant they were saying, in doing what they were doing, Gentiles aren't allowed into the temple. We don't think the Gentiles are worthy of being in the temple. We'll use the interesting thing, having gone to Jerusalem, there are actual places outside of the temple walls that there are stalls. I mean, they're still there, the stalls and places where they could have done this outside the temple. Mm-hmm. And obviously used to. But they were doing it in the temple. They were doing it in the court of the Gentiles, which meant they excluded the Gentiles forever participating in the temple. And remember, the temple was built so the Gentiles could participate in there. So they deemed who was worthy. They could exclude the Gentiles. It was also, remember we talked about this in Hebrews, the temple was also now the place that held the records of debt. So it was like you couldn't pay enough here. That's okay, we'll write it down. We'd love to write it down. And they kept all of the records of debt, which meant that they were giving forgiveness as a transactional thing. Mm-hmm. That they were making forgiveness. And this is what it means by they became someone who took away God's property of the kingdom, and they were holding it hostage within this system of the temple that they had made.
Their own book. I mean, he has a book of life.
Yep. Yep.
And they made their own books.
They made their own books. Yep. They had a lot of them. And they stored a lot of them. And what we know from history is that when the first thing that happened when Rome actually came in to destroy the temple, This is very interesting. The citizens, the first thing they did is ran in and burned the books of debt. Well, yeah, because that said whether they were worthy or not. So for all of the citizens are like, man, I got a book of debt, so bad. You know, there's no way I could pay it back. So in casting out the money changers and all of the sacrifices that they couldn't buy, it effectively stopped the sacrificial system. It effectively closed down the temple. So for that short amount of time.
Well, it forced the question.
It absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
It forced the question, yep. How will we be saved? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? How yep. will we have
yep.
access?
Yeah.
How will we get in?
So it forces the question, yeah. But remember what they've already seen. They've seen this Jesus who they all of a sudden understand. It looks like he's saying he's the Messiah. It looks like he's saying maybe he's the suffering servant. Not sure yet, but he's coming in as the new king. He comes into the temple and he shuts the temple down. And they're saying, how can we be saved? Where now does heaven and earth intersect? Mm-hmm. What he's saying is, it is me. I am where heaven and earth intersect. I've been showing you all along, every place I go, the normal things that happen in the kingdom are happening. People get fed out of 3 fish and 2 loaves. People are healed. People walk on water. Every place I am, heaven and earth are meeting. And this is why he goes to the temple, cleans it out, and says, it is me where heaven and earth meet. This is where you will experience the place of wholeness in me. So without understanding that background, it's just like he's just tired of these people taking advantage of God. It's much more than that. It's much bigger than that for the people who saw that, because the next thing that happens, and I hope that you caught this. I just wanted to do the very next thing. What are we on? Yes. 14. Listen to this. And the blind and the lame came to him where? What? In the temple? Are they allowed in the temple? No. They cannot come in the temple. He has cleaned it out. I am where you find heaven and earth intersecting. You can come to me because I've been showing you all along. You come to me and I bring heaven to you. I heal you. I bring restoration. And now the lame and the blind come into the temple and he healed them. And the interesting thing, it says, but when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he had done, and that actually means wonderful, amazing, they couldn't believe it. And then what else did they see? What do they see after that, the chief priest?
Children
shouting in the temple, Hosanna to the Son of David. They became indignant. What have you done with our temple? What have you done with our system that held our hierarchy up? What have you done with everything? You're making heaven and earth come into you, and you're letting the blind and the lame into the temple. You're letting children into the temple. And you should go all the way back to when Jesus says, this is what the kingdom is full of. Children, little ones who have nothing to give. That's what the kingdom is like. Right here in the temple, he just explodes everything and says, here, it is in me that the blind and the lame and the children can come. You don't see anyone else here but the blind and the lame and the children and the chief priests in just...
Because they were the ones following him.
Right. They were the ones following him. Of course they were the ones following him. And so we see that the stopping of the system enabled him to now fill, not, and I shouldn't have put system here, place. He fills the place. God has now come back to his temple. God has now filled it. And in fact, here he himself is the temple, which is why we have Luke and Mark talking about him saying, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will build it up. Because he's come to the temple now and he said, I am the temple. Him standing there was saying, I am the temple. I am the place where heaven and earth intersect and God's presence is full.
The accusation on him that sent him to the cross. The accusation that bothered people was that he was overturning their system.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's exactly.
I mean,
yes.
He's saying he can destroy our system.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right, which he has, and he's done it, and here it is. And this is a place of judgment again. What? So, whose authority? Can this person standing in the temple be the temple? Can he be the one who restores? Does he have the right and the power to be able to do it? And of course, since we have the blind and the lame and the children coming, and we know what Jesus has been doing all along, he's been building up. For the Jews who had eyes, they would have seen this build up. And this would have been the point where just everything just, whoa. Every paradigm has just been shut down, and they see the fulfillment of what they've been waiting for.
I can't help but see also the beautiful parallels that this new pope is bringing in this week.
So much. I so agree.
And so I don't know if you guys know, but like on Thursday, the Holy Thursday,
oh man,
the pope is supposed to go wash 12 people's feet. This is what he does every year. And this year he went to a prison.
I know. Aww. It just made me.
And he washed the feet of women, which he has no pope has ever done before, who were Muslim. And he kissed them. He didn't just wash them. He kissed their feet.
Yes.
And then on Sunday, when he celebrated Easter Mass, he took a child with cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And took him in to his breast and just embraced him. Someone who couldn't come on their own,
right.
Who literally needed to be lifted.
That's right.
By others to be in his presence. But anyway, the whole point is there's this debate going on in the church. And the debate is the law, the papal law says he cannot touch these people.
Yep.
The papal law says he should not be touching women. He should not be, you know, grabbing people like this. And so they're like, what do we do with this? And this one Catholic blogger says, well, I guess we have to remember that papal law is the word of the Pope. And if the Pope is embodying something different, then that is what the law is. And so it was just this beautiful picture of what Jesus was doing this whole week and saying, are you going to get stuck?
Yep.
In the law?
Yep.
Or are you going to see that incarnation is more important than the law?
Mm-hmm.
And then incarnation becomes the word.
Right.
Anyway, it was just so beautiful to see him not riding on the horse, not elevating himself in the ordination. He came down and he was not living in the palace. He is living with the workers of the palace of the Pope and only holding his meetings in there. And it's just so beautiful. I think I was so moved with these pictures because it felt like heaven breaking into earth.
Yep.
Those
moments
where you see the kingdom, the upside down of the kingdom feels like heaven breaking into earth, you know?
Yep. And I do think that even within that, so I would say most of the world is ignorant of what's been happening there. For those who've been looking, a lot of them are like, "What? He's not supposed to do that. He's not wearing his red shoes. He's not doing, you know, he's not doing this. He's not wearing." But then there's this part. There's part of us that are like, "Yes,
finally, there's a servant.
A servant. Someone who's actually serving. This is how it would have gone down here.
Yeah.
Exactly how it's going down."
And the
now,
most excited are the people who've been out.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Left and felt like they couldn't be
right.
in.
Right.
And now
they're
saying, I can be in. You know what I mean?
Yep. So I love that picture that we have that now. That's what they were feeling then. All different sections of people. And there are... Probably what we don't know is there are a good amount of people that are really nervous about this pope. I've read a couple of things.
No, they're upset.
They're like, he can't do this because it will disturb our system.
Well, they said sacred means set apart.
Yes.
Not set apart.
Okay, yes. Which is, I mean, we hear that all the time, don't we? Sacred is set apart. Actually, sacred is just the opposite. Sacred is where heaven meets earth. Sacred is where I touch the leper. That's what Jesus is saying is, you've got this all wrong. You've got this idea of sacred being here, and we don't want to touch. And he's going, no, it's sacred touches. Heaven touches earth.
What's to do with the heart? I mean, that's what sacred is heart dedicated
to God. Yeah, absolutely. And to others. We cannot have, God is Trinity, and it will always be with others.
It's beautiful, because he has given all authority
for
many, many people in the world.
Yes.
We should pray for him.
Yes, absolutely. I hope you have.
He's giving you a new picture of this authority that we're reading about.
So with Jesus entering the temple and doing what he's doing, he's bringing to mind the understanding that what normally happens in the kingdom is forgiveness, is healing, is abundance, celebration. That's what happens in the kingdom. When he brings his authority and restores, when he brings heaven to earth, that's what's going to be happening. And that's what's been happening with Jesus, and now it's just this huge climax to bring that. And of course, if it was a movie, we'd end here. Like, that's it, he brought it, you know? But what Jesus does now in Matthew here is, it's like, okay, so here's the question. What are you going to do about this authority? Are you going to trust that the way he restores is restoring? Or are you still going to trust yours? And here's what he understands. He knows that we all have ambiguity. He knows that we all have times where, yes, I trust God. I believe that he's doing restoring me. But there's a lot of me that I still trust what I think the picture should be. I mean, Paul says it, right? I want to do this, but I can't do what I want to do. I've got this battle going back and forth. Jesus knows that. And so he really wants us to wrestle with it. Not to go, well, that's just how it is. But to wrestle with this so that we become more and more trusting of his authority to restore. A real Israel will wrestle with God.
That's its name.
That's exactly why he named Israel Israel. We are to wrestle with that because we have this ambiguity. And he doesn't want us to just live with this ambiguity, but to wrestle with it. And to wrestle with it to the point where I say, I can't do it, God. My authority just messes things up. Hosanna, save! Oh, save! He wants us to yell that out. Again, like Elijah said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? When I wrestle with God about authority, my authority or his, my ability to bring life or his ability, there are going to be two ways to approach it. And so that's what he's coming toward. Now, I'm trying to decide because obviously I got lots to go here. If I want to go to the fig tree, because this is the one where it's very different, I think, than we've heard before. And I'm only going to give it to you as a one perspective. We're not going to get through the end, obviously. The fig tree parable is really about challenging authority. Remember, that is the subject here, is authority. We do take this one out and say it's about prayer. It's about authority and challenging authority. So we have a lone fig tree here that has no fruit when Jesus comes to get it. Okay, one thing you need to understand about fig trees is they always have fruit. Always. A fig tree's fruit comes out and it stays on the tree even when new fruit comes. So a fig tree always has fruit on it. There's never a time that a fig tree only has leaves. Okay, so understanding that helps understand the beginning of this parable here. So what he's saying here, yep.
And that Bethpage or whatever,
yep.
Means the valley of ripe fig trees.
Ah, the valley of ripe fig trees. There we go. So we have two, I mean, it's a huge intersection of a fig tree is supposed to have figs on it, always. It's always supposed to have figs on it. This one has none. He's using it as a picture of a person. They often say a fig tree is the picture of Pharisees, but it's really the picture of anyone who does not accept the wholeness that was meant to have. It's not producing exactly what it's supposed to be. It's not living. In other words, it's refusing the authority that Jesus has to restore. And it's saying, I'm going to be my own authority. I'm going to choose when I have fruit. I'm going to choose my timing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's that picture of a person who's going to choose when they have fruit, when they not, and how they're going to have it and when they don't have it. Their own authority. So that's what that picture of that fig tree is there, is someone who is really under his own authority. Jesus wants to challenge. What he's saying to the disciples is, you can challenge that in yourself. You all have that in yourself. You all have that place where you want to be the authority, where you want to be the one that makes the decisions. But you can challenge that, and you can say to it, with the little faith you have, die. That unbelieving part of you, die. If you take the little faith you have, you can say to that unbelieving part of you, die. This is not, I don't want to have that.
House of unripe figs.
Okay. This weekend, the exact same thing came to me. We had some plans, and somebody decided to change the plans. And I'm like, I mean, just my hackles came up. No, we're not going to change those plans. That would be terrible. This would be... And my picture, and I, once plans are made, I have like a static picture. It cannot be changed. And someone changed the plans, and I was just all up in arms. And because I was up in arms, no, that's not a good thing to change pictures. You're changing pictures on everybody now. You can't do this. And what happened is it caused a lot of pain for other people because I lashed out. I lashed out at the plan changer and said, no, that can't happen. And so me holding on to, no, this is the only way it could be good, made me lash out and ruin a relationship for that moment. It was actually pretty ugly. And I had to come back. I've already been studying this, and I sat back and I said, what am I doing here? I am saying to myself that my authority, I think this is right and this should happen, and I'm so holding on to it, I'm not willing to challenge. Let me challenge this, Jill. Okay. Is my authority bringing life? Is it bringing restoration? No, it's not. And I had to go to God and say, man, God, I did not think that you could restore if the plans were changed. Now, that sounds so simple and so ridiculous, but we're there all the time. We come to this place, I don't believe if plans gets changed, or I don't believe if this doesn't happen, that God is going to use that to restore, or that God can, or that God has the right to, or that God has the right to restore in changing my plans. And I had to wrestle with that and challenge that. Okay, challenge that non-producing fig tree in me that really was trusting my own authority. So am I making
like
sense to you?
Pruning okay. Your tree of life, essentially. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we're supposed to be have these branches out mm-hmm. in the birds lane, and every once in a while, out comes this branch where it's actually of the tree of managing.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, the tree of managing. Yeah.
Good and evil.
Yeah, right, exactly.
The tree of knowledge is good and
right,
evil, right?
Right,
so all of a sudden you're like, whoa, wait a minute. That seed must have fell over here and it just kind of,
yep, kind of came up.
My tree of life and I have this branch where I'm managing good and evil.
Yeah.
And so that needs to die, that
yes,
branch.
Yes, right.
Because that fruit is not even going
to
be good anyway.
Right. And that's what he's saying to the disciples. If you have faith, take that little faith you have, that faith can say to the mountain of faith, a mountain of distrust, of unbelief, go jump in a sea. Drown yourself. That is not good or beneficial for anybody. So do you understand this is under this authority thing is you're trusting your own authority. Yes, we all have this. But he's saying with the faith you do have, you can use that to say, die that part of the faith. Die. Call out, God, Hosanna, save me from my distrust of you here.
Did the situation turn out better than what you had envisioned, and were you able to make it right quickly?
It's still in progress, I think. But definitely when I wrestled with it, rather than sometimes you just like, okay, I was wrong, let me go on. I really needed to wrestle with what's underneath this. I asked myself, why are you holding onto that picture so hard? What do you think you're going to get out of this? So that wrestling really, for me, meant I had to question myself. And it's really, I was holding on. And of course, I'm not thinking this when I'm doing it, but afterwards, stepping back. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So, but I did apologize. And I did, you know, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's, and it's going to always be there. And Jesus knows this. This is why he's telling his disciples this story. You too can get rid of that. You have faith. And yes, you're going to have this distrust also that I'm, because look what they're going into. He's telling them, you need to trust me on this. I need to die. Because that's how the kingdom's going to come. It really, really? I mean, that's got to be really hard. So yeah, you're going to have this. But you can have the faith to actually say, jump in the lake. You don't need that.
That's really helpful the way you're describing it. If all of us are disciples or becoming disciples, we're going to have things like that, the little things.
Mm-hmm.
And he was actually preparing them
for
later.
Right.
So when they went through their own crucifixion.
Right.
Or,
Or Peter with his...
Exactly.
Yes.
So I see it just in a whole different light.
Yes.
So
I mean,
we have the authority because he's given us the authority.
Exactly.
And my other question is the word temple the same as when he said your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit?
Mm-hmm.
So just this whole Easter time this year for me, it's been more about this. He calls this, my body is the temple, and he wants to declutter.
Yeah.
And
throw out the money changers, throw out the transactions.
Yeah, just a whole plethora of things.
Yep.
I wondered if it was the same.
Yeah, it's the same. And that's really what will come for the next couple of weeks is we're going to learn the authority we have to have heaven and earth meet. We have that authority that he's going to give us.
But ironically, the authority is not to make something really cool happen.
Right, exactly.
Necessarily. Yeah. Although it happens, right?
Yes,
it
sure,
happens.
Sure.
People get healed and you pray.
Yes.
And marriages get healed and you pray.
Yep.
But like ironically, that's about actually killing something.
Yes.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like the mountain into the sea is
That
thing was not supposed to be there.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
No, I mean, this helps me understand the seven people a little bit more too, because it's giving up my authority instead of being the martyr.
Yeah.
Because if I'm the martyr, I'm still
Honoring
glory.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I knew that hopefully this would help. So he's saying, I want you to challenge authority. But you can come at it two ways. You can challenge authority with the express purpose of being able to submit to true authority. Mm. Or you can challenge authority with the express purpose of building up your own authority, which is what the chief priest did, right? So the chief priest, they ask him, where did you get this authority? And who gave it to you? And they want to know, all about this. Do they really want to know where his authority comes from?
No, they want to keep him in an answer.
They just want to trap him so that their authority is justified. So that their authority is put forth as good. Now, here's what they're fearing. They're fearing a loss of their power source, first of all. Where do you have any idea where the Pharisees, the chief scribes, the priests, where their power source would be? Where are they getting their power?
The temple?
No.
Oh.
It's even bigger. The Romans.
Oh, okay.
It's the Romans.
They were
completely sold to the Romans. Remember, none of them are true line of Levite. They've all made up their own. From the Maccabees on, they all made up their own priesthood. They've got these Pharisees and Sadducees that were never a part of that. They've made up their own hierarchy. And they've done that with the blessing, and in fact, Rome always, this is how Rome always worked, it took already corrupt people who were leaders and put them up as puppet leaders. Everywhere they conquered, they did that. It was much easier for them to use the people that were there than to have their own people come in, because people were much willing to to submit. And especially to use God and the temple stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Because since Caesar's God, You know, they want to make sure that they use, you know, a God-ish thing. So they're afraid that they'll lose their power source because why? Rome has also seen Jesus coming in on the donkey. Rome has also understood that this is a declaration of a new reign coming in. And they are. This is why they want him to shut up. Don't let those people do that. Are you kidding me? Rome will come in and they'll take over and they'll throw us out and they'll stay. They'll make themselves this. This is. They are very afraid of Rome coming in here. They don't want anybody to upset that cart. But they're also fearing not only their power source, but their power base. And what's their power base? It would be the people. The people underneath them who are having to come to them for forgiveness or having to come to them for their debts. They don't want the people being their power base being undermined by Jesus saying, I'm the place where heaven and earth meet. So we basically have cultural, we have social, and we have in the next one their personal lives. So they work to justify their own life. Their religious box is working well for them. So they have to get rid of the challenger. But let me back up and say, we don't necessarily need to see the chief priests and the Pharisees and all as evil. Because if we do, if we see them as evil, in quotes, we will say that's them. But they are very much like us. They literally got so caught up in transactional world that they really believed that Jesus was doing detriment to God's place. They really believed that because they got caught up in a transactional life. We do the same thing. When we're caught up in the transactional life, we believe that many things, forces are we need to defend God against. And so we become a people who are against everything, mm-hmm. right? And man, just the other day, I'm reading more statistics about what people see Christians as against. And that's what the Pharisees were. That's what the chief scribes were. So we get the same thing. So be careful not to make them so evil that they're them, because they're us. Exactly that. They really felt that they were defending God in doing this. And here's a way for you to kind of hone that for yourself. Ask yourself, when I'm defensive, when I'm defending something, when I'm against something, what am I defending? Am I defending God's grace? Am I defending forgiveness? Am I defending his desire to heal? Am I defending access for little ones, ones who have nothing to give? Am I defending these? Or am I defending a system or a hierarchy or a formula or comfort? That's what will help you know if you're in that place or not. And believe me, we're in the Pharisee place just as much, if not more, than we are in the other place. Defending God's grace, though, is very different, isn't it? Boy, if you're defending God's grace, you don't look like what we've normally thought. You look a lot more like Jesus. You say, no, it's these people can come in. No, it's okay to be with these people. It's okay to touch these people. It's okay to have dinner with sinners and prostitutes.
You know what I saw the first time when we watched The Passion again when I was doing it with the family? I saw that Jesus forgave the Pharisees.
Yes, yes. And they didn't want it.
Well, but he still said, Father, yep. Forgive yes. them. Yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We can look and say, well, the religious system, whatever, he was at the cross saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
Right.
So
right.
until he touches my blind eyes,
yep.
I can't see.
Right.
Sometimes I don't
right.
even know where I'm blind.
Right.
But
right.
So he forgave them as well.
Yep. He did. Completely. Completely. So all right, so I'll ask you a question. We have two more parables to go through. It's after 11:30. Yes? No? Keep going? Or
I have to go.
Or we can end it there.
I'll stay.
Okay. All right. We'll keep on going if you want to listen to the last part of it. Go ahead. The parable of the two brothers. So what he has is, look, judgment is about you're going to be the judge, actually. You have to choose. You have to make a decision about what authority. So here, choose authority. The parable of the two brothers is about accepting true authority, and accepting true authority means trusting. It doesn't mean working. It doesn't mean saying words. It doesn't even mean repentance. It means faith. It means trust. I am trusting that whatever my Father's will is true and good, and I want to embrace it. He alone has the right and the ability to restore things. Then my behavior follows. Because since he has the right to restore things, and he knows what's best to restore things, he's going to say, go out and do this, and my behavior will follow because I trust that what he's saying is restorative. The question really is, what is the Father's will? And it's assumed here that you understand what the Father's will is. He's already talked about it in Matthew. He will say it over and over again. The Father's will is that you believe him, that you trust that the kingdom is coming through his restorative actions, that he's restoring all. That's what Jesus asked us to pray. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. His will is that the kingdom comes, that heaven meets earth in us, that we trust that that's what he's doing. If that's his will, and we know that because he goes on to say it's the prostitutes and what was the tax collectors that believed. They believed John, and they believed what came after. But you priests, you chief priests, you scribes, you didn't even give the call a second thought because you were so busy protecting and building up what you thought was God, what you thought was your service to God, rather than understanding that God's will is that heaven and earth meet here. So the first son actually finally trusts that his father's will is good and beneficial and that he should do it. The second son says that he thinks it's good. Yes, I'll do it. But he believes that his authority is much more important. And what's his authority? Just like the fig tree. I will decide what to do, when to do it. And so he doesn't do it. So it's really just kind of a rehashing kind of that fig thing. He's resentful of the grace. So it kind of is pulling in from the very beginning, the vineyard growers to the fig tree and now to the brothers. Where there's no fruit, there's a rejection of authority. A rejection of the authority to restore. I don't want grace. I want to choose what I do, when I do it. I want to, what I accept as life, my picture, my kingdom, I want to be the ultimate decision maker. That's what the second brother's doing. I want to be the ultimate decision maker. I will decide when I do it. The first son, that's how he first starts out. But then all of a sudden he decides, oh, you know what? My father's will is actually for my good. I don't know how it will be, but it's for my good, and I will go out there and do it. He then goes on to the parable of the vine growers, which is the other side, is co-opting authority, taking away God's authority so that I have it for myself. So this parable, the vine growers, what goes on here? We have another
vineyard owner leaves the vine growers to take care while he's gone, and he sends a slave to collect what has been sold or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they kill him, and then he sends another slave and they kill him too, and then he says, oh, surely they won't kill my son, but they kill him also.
Mm-hmm.
And just want for themselves, and then they're thrown out, and he's going to put in vine growers that are honest.
Okay. So one of the things that Jews would have understood is there's a passage in Isaiah that says the vineyard of the Lord is the house of Israel. So when they talk about a vineyard, that's Israel. And the people of Judah are his pleasant plantings. So Israel is his chosen vineyard from which he will feed all the nations.
Do you know what passage that is?
Isaiah 5:7. But he has given the care of the vineyard of Israel to the religious leaders. Now, who did God give the care to? The Levites. They have made their own hierarchy here. There are Levitical tribes in there, but it's completely messed up. It's not a clean line. They've made their own, but that's who he's given the care over to. The servants in this parable are the prophets. God sent the prophets over and over and over again, and they continued to beat them and stone them and kill them because they were always saying, no, no, change your mind. It's not about you having authority. And so what we see here then, the authority we're talking about is the kingdom, the stewardship of the kingdom, holding it as your property, as if it's up to you to maintain it and keep it safe. And that it's yours. So, of course, we have the servants getting killed, the prophets getting killed over and over again until, of course, the son comes. And it's interesting that he would have this here, knowing that that's, of course, what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Because he's already told them, I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. So they should begin to see that he's talking about himself. But when we decide that it's our right to control the gospel, when it's our right to control the good news, we start making boxes to protect it. You know, there's this part of us that thinks it's a good thing. We got to protect the gospel, as if us holding on to it is going to protect it. When he says it's you giving it up, it's you allowing it to be as full as it needs to be. In the parable here, they seize the mystery, the stewardship of the gospel, the stewardship of the kingdom by violence. They're basically saying, get away, get away, get away. We're in charge of this. We don't want anyone to mess up. We don't want anyone. And so they begin to put all sorts of rules and laws around it, and they feel like they need to be the protector of that. They don't want anyone to take it from them because they're afraid that if anyone else holds on to the gospel, they're going to mess it up, really. So we got to protect it. We got to make sure that it doesn't get watered down. We got to make sure that it doesn't get twisted. You know, we got to protect that. When we rant against other people, the way other people display their faith or what they do, that's part of that. No, no, no. When we say this is how you got to come to Jesus this way, you got to say this. That's this. That's I'm protecting it. You've got to be this way. He said you're stewards of it. You're not gatekeepers. You're not trying to keep it in. You're supposed to tend it so that it grows more and more, so that it feeds more and more people. But these, of course, people say that they want it. And then he says, he calls them wretches, which is a really interesting word. Wretches actually means one who retreats from battle because they are content to perish in their own corruption or by their own hand. They're content to kill themselves, basically. Rather than let die to their picture, rather let them picture die, they're willing to go away from the battle. And that's what I mean by when Jesus says, challenge this authority, challenge that. They're willing to just walk away. No, I'm going to keep my own here. I'm going to just die myself. When we defend our own authority, we cut ourselves off from grace. And when we cut ourselves off from grace, we don't have the ability or the authority, the right and the power to give grace to others. And we don't allow our own picture to die. And yet, of course, we've already talked about death being the mechanism of the kingdom anyways to restore. And so the last thing he says basically is, you choose a wretched end. And don't think of end, as what we think as final. Just think of the fact that you choose, you're judging yourself, you're saying that when I keep it like this, you hug it to death, basically. and you're only going to find that you become dust. That he says, if you aren't allowing the stone, the cornerstone, to break you of your picture, of your authority, then you will be crushed by it. You will completely go to dust, which always brings up the point, well, what happens to dust? For another lesson. But if you don't fall on the cornerstone, then it will crush you. So you have to be broken of your own authority, because your own authority will crush you and will bring you to death. I think that's as far as I want to go in that. Father, thank you for so much, so many pictures of who you are, and it's really exciting to know that heaven and earth was met in you, but that it didn't end there, that it was just the beginning of the kingdom coming to fruition, and that we know that you've passed on that authority to us, and that we get to see and experience the kingdom more and more as we submit to your authority, know that your rule is a rightful rule and a powerful rule, able to restore us and all of creation. We praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.